Well, I'd like to also thank the organizers, and especially Daniel and Oleg for giving me this opportunity to talk about our work here. My talk is going to be about finite temperature and ground state properties of Kagome antiferromagnets. And it's done in collaboration with Marcos Rigol, who was a postdoc at UC Davis. He's currently a postdoc with Sriram Shastri at Santa Cruz and is joining Georgetown as an assistant professor next year. And David Hughes, who I think most people know here, was at Princeton. And the work has been published in PRL and PRB, and this work with David Hughes is coming out in Rapid Communications pretty soon. Okay, so I guess Daniel made the remark during Michelle's talk yesterday that is a lot of work here motivated by theory rather than experiment alone. It's fair to say that a lot of the work on Kagome antiferromagnets is theoretically motivated. And my talk is actually going to follow sort of that order. First, I'll discuss mostly theoretical work on the model. And then I'll, fortunately, you know, over the last year or so, some new materials have been discovered that actually are spin-half Kagome lattice antiferromagnets. And there have been some talks here before, but I guess I will go through some of the experimental details and see to what extent we understand them. Actually, the materials are far from understood right now, so I should say that at the very outset. So I'm going to give a very general introduction to Kagome lattice antiferromagnets for those who are not so familiar with it. So everybody knows the triangular lattice, one of the standard Bravais lattices in two dimensions. The Kagome lattice is basically, you can think of it in many ways, but one way is that you remove every fourth site out of this triangular lattice, and that makes it, that turns it from a edge-sharing or bond-sharing lattice to one where the triangle shares sites. And this site, this depletion, actually makes the system much, much more frustrated. So let's see why. Well, first, let me talk about the Ising model on such lattices. So if I consider a single triangle, one of the classic examples of frustration with antiferromagnetic interaction, it's clear that I can satisfy one bond and maybe a second one, but not the third one. And what this does is that out of the eight possible ground states that a spin-half Ising model would have, six of them are actually ground states. So the only two states that are not ground states of this triangle are when you put all up or all down. So six out of eight are ground states. Now, this is really the hallmark of frustration, basically. Now, if we consider Ising model on the full lattice, following Onsager's techniques, I mean, these models are still exactly soluble. One can see that the Kagome lattice model is more frustrated than the triangular lattice in the following sense. In case of the triangular lattice model, in both models, there is a finite ground state entropy. That is, a large fraction of the states remain ground states. And so, you know, they are still active, if you like, even at zero temperature. In case of the triangular lattice model, about 50% of the total entropy remains at T equals zero. For the Kagome lattice, it's about 72%, so it's more frustrated, clearly. Also, if you look at the correlation length in the triangular lattice model, as the temperature is lowered, the correlation length diverges, and basically the T equals zero is like a critical point. So spins are getting correlated at very long distances. Whereas for the Kagome lattice model, the correlation length remains short and of the order of one lattice constant, really down to T equals zero.
Are you thinking about what about classical model?
This purely Ising, Ising model. Pure Ising model. This is just pure Ising. Okay, now let's consider the Heisenberg model. Now, once we have spins which are vectors rather than something that can only take values 1 or minus 1, in a single triangle, this degeneracy can be actually removed. Frustration can actually be removed basically by simply canting the spins. And so since the sum of the Heisenberg interactions, classical Heisenberg interactions, can simply be written as the sum of the square of the spins, all you want is that the three spins on the triangle must add up to zero, and that leads to this 120-degree structure, where the three spins on a triangle, they each make an angle of 120-degree with respect to each other. And once, this is where the difference between the corner sharing and the side sharing comes in, that on the triangular lattice, if we were really dealing with a triangular lattice model with a spin everywhere, that then once we have fixed the spin in one triangle, the spin in the entire lattice is fixed. Because these, if I go to the next spin over here, this has to be at 120-degree with respect to both these. So this is fixed. Then this guy will be fixed, because it has to be 120-degree with respect to both these. And you'll find that the entire lattice, the ground state structure is uniquely determined once the state in a single triangle has been set, basically. As opposed to that, when we go to the Kagome lattice model, where all these guys are removed, one suddenly obtains, again, an exponentially large number of ground states. And one quick way to see that there are exponentially large number of ground states now, is let's look at this particular structure. So this structure is actually also called the root 3 by root 3 structure, because this has a unit cell of root 3 by root 3. So in this structure over here, suppose we don't have these guys. So we are talking about a Kagome lattice model. Then if I look, for example, at this hexagon over here, then all the spins outside this hexagon are pointing up. And that means that suppose I choose all the up spins in the entire lattice to be pointing up, then inside every hexagon, there is going to be a continuous degeneracy. That is, you can basically choose this spin to point along any direction in a 120-degree cone with respect to this up spin over here. And that can be done locally for all such hexagons, okay, separated from each other. And that tells you that there is a local degeneracy in this model. And so there are a huge number of classical ground states. Now, that is, of course, not the only structure in which the model can order. Here is another prominent structure, Q equals zero structure, where basically every triangle is ordered the same way. And in this case, the appropriate wave vector here is basically Q equal to zero. One can also double the unit cell in one direction. So for example, if I change the spin direction in these guys over here, then basically that will correspond to a Q equal to M, which is halfway, which is at the center of the Brillouin zone boundary, basically. So one can get various different types of ordered structure. And the question is, which structure is favored by various things? So for example, one could have order by disorder here. So there are calculations by David Hughes and Andy Rittenberg's showing that if you had a classical Heisenberg model, then thermal order by disorder actually favors this root 3 by root 3 structure. But in general, one can also imagine that the system is very sensitive to further neighbor interactions, which can favor one structure or another.
Excuse me. Is there some general way to see that the quantum fluctuations and the thermal fluctuation will select the same ground state for triangles, or it's not?
It's I don't know that it is known that.
It is not known.
Well, I believe their results was for thermal fluctuations, that this state is selected. But
I think the paper by Chubukov.
Yes, for quantum fluctuations,
is this the same structure is selected?
I think he argues that the square root 3 is a bit more predominant because of quantum fluctuations. But it's pretty difficult, pretty opaque paper. It's a PIL, which, you know, it's hard to get after the details, but that's the conclusion of the paper. This would be square root 3.
There's certainly lots of local, there are lot more states around the root 3 by root 3 structure. Okay, the main interest of the talk here is the quantum Heisenberg model, where these spins are spin half SU2 operators, which obey the usual commutation relations. And we are interested really in the spin half case, where we know that if we have a pair of spins connected by this exchange, antiferromagnetic exchange, the spin likes to form rotationally invariant singlets. And the question is, what happens if we have the whole lattice? What kind of state is realized? Okay, so there are many, many proposals and many open questions in this field over here, so I'm going to summarize some of them. Well, one possibility is that the ground state is actually magnetically ordered. This will be an example of spontaneous symmetry breaking, basically, as has been shown very nicely by Claire, Lullier, and others in case of the triangular lattice. I'll show some of their data here for the Kagome lattice as well. Another possibility is that the ground state can form a valence bond crystal. That is, you know, each spin might preferentially pair up with a particular neighboring spin and thus give us a valence bond crystal state. And part of my discussion here is about a calculation for which valence bond crystal state is likely to be selected. There are, of course, other very exciting possibilities. There could be a quantum spin liquid, perhaps some kind of resonating valence bond state where there's a linear superposition of many different valence bond states coming into play. There's a question of, is there a spin gap in such a system? Is there algebraic spin order? I mean, Matthew and various collaborators have talked about the possibility of critical spin liquids in two dimensions where the spin-spin correlations decay algebraically. There could be fractional spin excitations like spin-ons if we have some kind of an RVB state. There's also this very interesting possibility of massless Dirac spin-ons. There's a particular flux phase ground state that has been that was originally proposed by Matt Hastings and has been studied a lot more by Patrick Lee and collaborators, where they argue that this system has Dirac spin-on-like particles. So, you know, which one of these is realized? Okay, well, let me first talk about the one that I think we are pretty...
Maybe before you go to this one, can you say a couple of words, actually, what is known really about S1-half for triangular
lattice? I'll come to that. Maybe when I show Claire's data, we will... but that's a good question. So, for the triangular lattice, there seems to be, I think, a growing evidence that the system has long-range order.
But
120-degree structure. It is not it's not as robust as the square lattice, but at zero temperature, it is not much weaker. So in other words, if the square lattice retains 60% of the sublattice magnetization of the classical state, the triangular lattice retains around 40% or somewhat less than 40%. Okay. However, the triangular lattice is clearly very susceptible to thermal fluctuations. And so at very low temperatures, actually, the system disorders, okay, and has a very short correlation length. So first, let me talk about the issue of magnetic long-range order. And as I discussed, there are many possible candidates, the root 3 by root 3 structure, Q equal to 0, Q equal to M, and so on. The answer from various computations appears to be that there is no long-range order for the spin half case. And the most, impressive, numerical results come from exact diagonalization spectra, which I will show briefly. There was an early series expansion work that David Hughes and I did, which was looking specifically for this root 3 by root 3 ordered structure. And we found that this structure is not obtained in this model because as we do an Ising type expansion, the system undergoes a phase transition and this order goes away. So that was specifically looking for root 3 by root 3 structure, but we did not look at other structures over here. But really, exact diagonalization studies really strongly point towards something other than long-range magnetic order. So most of our information really on these systems comes from exact diagonalization, which has been done by Claire and collaborators, and also by White, Elser, and Zheng, and Frederick Miele, and Brad Marston, and many others. Clusters up to 36 sites with periodic boundary condition have been studied. There are more than 36 site clusters that can be that are different from each other that can be drawn on the Kagome lattice. To my knowledge, only one of them has actually been studied numerically. The basic message is that there are lots of low-lying singlets, and in fact, there are claims that the number of singlets below the triplet really grows exponentially fast as the number of spins goes up. So let me show the basic data over here, and this is one of the things I really like about the ITP and the arrangement of putting all the slides on the web is that you can borrow slides from others. So this is a slide taken from Claire's talk, which she gave earlier during this program. And it really dramatically shows the difference between the square lattice, the triangular lattice, and the Kagome lattice. Can everybody see the spectra here clearly? Okay. So there is a dramatic difference. So, they have characterized the states completely, low-lying states of the system completely in terms of the spin quantum number. And this x-axis actually shows the momentum quantum numbers, so it's not important to know exactly what another point group quantum numbers. It's not important to know exactly what they are. This axis is energy over here. The energy scale has been the axis has been rescaled to show the basic structure over here. So you can see this is what happens when you have spontaneous symmetry breaking. That these states over here, so-called Anderson Tower of states that lead to spontaneous symmetry breaking, are clearly well separated from all other states, okay? And it's the linear superposition, the slope of these guys is supposed to go to zero in the thermodynamic limit, and it's a linear superposition of these guys that gives us a broken symmetry state. On the triangular lattice, you can see that the energy scale is much smaller over here. So basically the excitation energy scale is perhaps a factor of 4 or 5 smaller in the triangular lattice, but there is still a separation of these states over here relative to the other states, okay, not as clear, which suggests that perhaps spontaneous symmetry breaking applies in this system also, at least at these length scales, okay. There are other, I guess Daniel asked the question about triangular lattice, so we have done also some work on this using series expansions, and again, it points towards magnetic long range order in this root 3 by root 3 structure. And also there's recently a DMRG work by Steve White and Sasha Chernyshev, and they also find that structure is stabilized in the model. Now, if we look at the Kagome lattice, you see a dramatic difference. So there's clearly, you don't have these Anderson towers of state well separated from everybody else, but rather you see a huge number of states at extremely low energies. And most of these states are singlets. So these are the singlets over here. These are the triplets. For a 36-site cluster, there are only 4 allowed distinct K vectors, really. There is this gamma point, which is Q equals 0. There's this point K, which corresponds to the root 3 by root 3 structure, for example. This M point and this P point. And one can see that basically there are huge number of singlets that are below the lowest triplet over here. Okay, that strongly suggests that the low energy physics of this model has something to do with singlets rather than with magnetic order.
What about triplet states? Do they have gap?
Yes, that's what I'm coming to next. So
these singlets, what's the current understanding of their classical parents or whatever, where did they come from?
That's not so clear, but I will talk about that also. Yes, so if you see, there is a gap to the lowest triplet in this system, of course. This scale that is being shown over here is the energy per site. Okay, so it's not like the triplet gap is that small. It's actually around 0.15 when you multiply it by the number of sites. So here is a plot. And now I believe Claire showed some new plots of the gap versus 1 over n. So this plot shows two things. Let's first focus on the lower curve over here. So this is the spin gap. That is really the energy of the spin 1 state relative to the lowest energy state as a function of 1 over n. And for the 36-site system, this gap is about 0.15 or so. Okay, and these are various attempts to extrapolate to n going to infinity, that is the thermodynamic limit, and the earlier claims were that it was extrapolating to a value of about 0.05 in units of J. There are some more recent points, and I have not actually seen them, But there are some claims that it is also consistent with a much smaller value, perhaps even zero. That the gap in the thermodynamic limit could be very small, or it could even be zero. But I would argue that, you know, that the extrapolation is subtle over here. Okay, it's certainly not simple as a function of 1 over n. The other interesting quantity, which will be important in the discussions later on, is the ground state energy. And again, one can study the ground state energy by studying the spin-spin correlation functions, either for the spin zero state or various spin states over here as a function of size. And they are all extrapolating to some value over here that seems to be around minus 0.43 or minus 0.435 or something like that. But again, it's hard to exactly nail down what the ground state energy is. And they have usually quoted a number that it is in this interval over here, minus 0.43 to minus 0.44. Okay. Momentum dependence in the 36 sites cluster, again, there are four Q points over here. The minimum triplet gap is at Q equal to M. Okay, but the various Q values, we go back to that. The various Q values are actually relatively close. Compared to this 0.15 over here, they are within some 0.01 of each other. Okay, so they are very, very close to each other. So these three Q values are the important ones over here. And the gap value is very close for all those.
This M point, I don't see it from here. It's not root 3.
Sorry, M point is here. Root 3 by root 3 is this K point here. So that's, in fact, that is the highest gap over here in this. Okay, so one thing that we, that David Hughes and I, following a talk that Patrick Lee gave at Princeton, that's how we started working on this, is that we went back to some calculation that Zheng and Elser had done, where they had calculated the spin and dimer correlations for the 36-site cluster. So we, in general, this is not a Bravais lattice, so there are three spins per unit cell. One can construct the 3x3 structure factor at any given Q and calculate the largest eigenvalue and ask, this is another measure of which Q is going to be favored. And when you calculate the largest eigenvalue, I've changed the notation over here from Claire. This Q is again the root 3 by root 3 structure. What you find is that the largest eigenvalue is actually at Q equal to 0, followed by Q equal to M, and this point is actually the smallest. Okay. One can also, they also looked at the dimer-dimer correlation function. Now there are actually 6 bonds per unit cell. So one can calculate the 6 by 6 dimer-dimer structure factor and again ask, which eigenvalue is the largest, and in this case, one finds that Q equal to M, the wave vector M is where the dimer-dimer structure factor gives you the largest value. So this is again some indication that the system might be trying to develop order at these wave vectors.
It's the same as saying that correlation function, the point correlation function is the maximum.
Right. Exactly. Because in this,
it's not really very short.
It's not, well, there are only 3-4 points on this cluster over here. So, you know. Okay. So now let me talk about.
So yes. Did you look at the same correlation as a function of temperature?
No, this is only at zero temperature.
Can it be done?
Not at low temperatures, but we can certainly do it at high temperatures, right, by a high temperature expansion. But we can do it through this series expansion that I'm going to briefly talk about now. Okay, so let me talk about the question of, is there a valence bond crystal phase? That's one of the candidate structures that has been proposed. And again, there have been many proposals, but I'm really going to focus on one that was originally made by Brad Marston and Zheng, and later on further elaborated upon by Nikolic and Sintel. And their arguments really begin with an SUN, where you generalize the model to SUN. In general, at large n, one tends to get these dimer states. And then when you consider the 1 over n expansion, that picks out states that have maximum number of resonances. So on a Kagome lattice, the smallest loop in which you can have these resonances are basically hexagons over here. And so what they have argued is that the valence bond crystal state would be one where you have maximum number of these resonating hexagons. Okay, so imagine putting three dimers in a same hexagon over here, so it can resonate between this structure and the other structure. Now it turns out that once you put, there is a certain density, once you put a resonating hexagon in one of, so one of, once you make one of these guys resonating hexagons, the neighbors can no longer be resonating. And once you put two of these guys, then it excludes actually further things from around it. Okay, so however, it still leaves lots of freedom as to how you put these hexagons, how you pack these hexagons. So one arrangement is what Nikolic and Sentil called a honeycomb valence bond crystal. So it's a structure where these hexagons, if you like, are arranged in the geometry of basically a honeycomb lattice. And another structure is one that can be called stripes, basically, where the hexagons pack in one direction like a stripe, and basically it breaks the threefold rotational symmetry of the crystal. But really there is a lot of freedom over here. So if I want to do it in a stripe-like fashion, I have the freedom to change from one row to the other over here, because I can simply move these guys up one lattice constant. And then in this row again, I can move these guys by one lattice constant. So there's quite a bit of freedom of choosing the states over here. Here actually, and I'll discuss this a bit more, you even have a local degeneracy. So you have huge number of states in here.
But wait a minute, once again, just to understand better. In the left picture, you have this, all these green hexagons, each of them contains three bonds, yeah?
Right.
And you have also some extra dimers.
That's right. So the others have to be dimerized also in some pattern. Okay. Once you fix, so you can ask, once I fix these guys, does that uniquely determine all the other dimers? And the answer is no, there is still some degeneracy left. And I'll talk about that maybe a little.
And in the stripe pattern, if I did fix hexagon, then again the three
there is a
hexagon?
In this case, the degeneracy is larger. Sorry?
No, in stripe pattern, three bonds per hexagon. Or
it's always three bonds per hexagon. But if you fix the hexagons here, you still have a freedom that is actually linear. So you will have a freedom to sort of move these guys around, but it's not an extensive number. You know, the number of states is not exponential in the size of the system. It grows only with the...
Is it green? Are they resonating or they are really again fixed?
Okay, so that's a question. Right, that's a question. So this theory only tells you that, you know, you should have maximum number of these, but it doesn't tell you whether they are fully resonating or not. I'll show you some evidence for what we find. Okay, so what we have done is what we call a dimer series expansion for the spin-half Heisenberg model. So I thought, since many people may not be familiar with this, I just want to very briefly explain what this means. And I have here a few examples where you can easily see what it means really. So a dimer expansion is something very, very simple. So consider any one dimer covering of the lattice, and all the bonds which are in the dimer covering, okay, so let's say all the blue bonds over here, all those Heisenberg interaction will be called H naught. And all other bonds will be multiplied by a factor of lambda, and so this will be part of the perturbation. So if we did nothing, if we set lambda to zero, the energy of the state is just the energy of disconnected dimers. And what we are doing is systematic perturbation theory in powers of lambda to calculate the energy of the state as well as the wave function and various correlations of the state as a function of lambda. Okay. So here, our goal is to understand which dimer state will lead to the lowest energy, okay, at lambda equal to 1. So let me show a few examples of what happens for some very simple models over here. If I just take a simple square, that's just a 2x2 problem because there are only two singlets you can put on a simple square. If you take this, you can easily diagonalize the 2x2 matrix, and you will see that basically as lambda goes to 1, you recover this symmetry over here. So you start off with a state which is just dimerized like this, but as you go to lambda equal to 1, you will end up with an equal superposition of these guys, and the system will be fully resonating. Similarly, if you take a hexagon, now this is a slightly harder calculation because there are six singlets you can put on a hexagon, but nevertheless, a relatively easy calculation, you can show that basically, if you set lambda equal to 0, you're basically going to get a structure like this, as you go towards lambda equal to 1, you will recover a full resonance over here. So the ground state will basically not be breaking this degeneracy anymore, not be breaking the symmetry of the hexagon when you go to lambda equal to 1. A more non-trivial example that we have worked a lot on and actually has a long history, going back to Brooks Harris and many others, is something where instead of just a small cluster like this, imagine a linear chain, an infinite chain over here, where the coupling basically goes as 1 lambda, 1 lambda, 1 lambda. Now, there are some materials which are strongly dimerized, where lambda, this copper nitrate material, for example, has lambda of 0.2 something. So it really is a strongly dimerized system, in which case such a perturbation expansion, of course, is extremely good. But my claim is that as you go to lambda equal to 1, you begin to recover a large number of properties of the Heisenberg chain in this case. Okay, so if you were to do this expansion to high orders, and we've done to some 15 or 20 orders for various properties, you can recover the ground state properties of the Heisenberg model, the excitations, lots of, you know, the fact that the gap goes to zero, the fact that one particle spectral functions go to zero, a lot of the properties of the continuum can be recovered by this kind of expansion. Let me give you another very simple example over here, which is sort of relevant. If I took the Majumdar-Ghosh model, which I'm sure most people are familiar with, but let me just say, it's a model where you have, say, a nearest neighbor interaction, J1, and a second neighbor interaction, which is J2. And it can be tuned in such a way that there are two ground states. One is where the spins are forming dimers like this, and the other where the spins form dimer like this. If I take this Majumdar-Ghosh model and do a series expansion in powers of lambda, nothing happens because this state is, of course, an eigenstate and the ground state simply doesn't change. So at lambda equal to 1, you, of course, get exactly the same state. So the idea is that if you have a state which has a valence bond crystal order, you are going to get a state at the end that continues to break the lattice symmetry, okay, in this expansion. Another example is, if I suppose I take the square lattice and I begin with a columnar dimerization like this and treat all other bonds as perturbation. If you were to do this calculation, what you will find is that the system has a phase transition at lambda c equals of order 0.5, it's like 0.4 or so, where there is actually a second order phase transition where the antiferromagnetic susceptibility diverges, the gap goes to zero, and the system goes into a phase for larger value of lambda, which has long-range magnetic order. So various things can happen on different lattices in different examples. Okay. So coming back to this particular problem, the calculation on the Kagome lattice is particularly simple. And we are able to do the calculation for an arbitrary dimer covering, for any dimer covering, because you can do it functionally for each dimer covering. And the reason why the calculation is simple is because when you put a dimer covering on the Kagome lattice, every triangle where you put a dimer is happy. Okay, for the ground state of a single triangle is any state where the three spins add up to spin half. And so if you take any two sides and couple them into a singlet, that's the ground state of the triangle. Okay, is everybody familiar with that? Okay, so what that means is that any place, it's just like in the Shastri-Sutherland model, and I've just drawn here the actual, this is the materials geometry, but there are easier ways to draw the Shastri-Sutherland model. But in that model, what happens is that every one of these strong bond is precisely occurs once in every triangle. And so if you form a singlet on all these bonds, that becomes an exact eigenstate of this entire Hamiltonian over here. And a ground state, obviously, when those bonds are stronger than the others. So in this case, again, when we put down a dimer covering, then every triangle where you have a strong bond is already in a ground state. So where do quantum fluctuations begin? Well, they have to begin with empty triangles. So it turns out, anytime you put down a dimer covering, there will be some triangles where all the dimers will be sticking out of the triangle. That's where quantum fluctuations have to begin. Yes?
But the ground state of a triangle is a doublet, but not every doublet is a ground state.
It turns out in this case, the ground state actually has four-fold degeneracy on a triangle. So, you know, it's not just the spin plus minus a half, but any state with spin a half, yeah, you can call it a quartet. So, you know, you can define it in terms of chirality or various things, but one way to say that is that, you know, if you put two spins into a singlet, the next spin can only be spin a half and it's a ground state. Okay, so quantum fluctuations have to begin from these so-called empty triangles. Okay, wherever the empty triangles are, that's where the quantum fluctuations will begin, and then of course they can propagate through the lattice. And this really simplifies the calculation. So if we want to do a dimer expansion to second order in the expansion, we only need to consider one graph, an empty triangle, basically. Then in the third order, you can have three empty triangles which meet together in a hexagon like this. Then in the fourth order, you get extra contributions from having two empty triangles like this, or one like this and another triangle like this on top of this, and so on. So up to fifth order, actually, only five graphs are needed. This is, for me, this is an amazing simplicity because I'm used to dealing with thousands of graphs when you're doing a calculation to some order. So this becomes particularly simple. And of course, one can easily count the number of each one of these for arbitrary dimer configuration. So what one finds is that the degeneracy of, so first of all, in zeroth order, it's clear that the energies will be the same because all dimer configurations have the same energy. In second order, again, the energies are going to be the same because the number of such empty triangles is a geometrical constraint, really. One-fourth of all triangles have to be empty anytime you put down a dimer covering. So up to second order, the degeneracy is not lifted. It's lifted in the third order, where basically you have a binding of these three empty triangles into the hexagon over here. Anytime you have a configuration like that, its energy is lowered, and I'll tell you by how much. In the fourth order, the honeycomb begins to win over the stripe because you want to have maximum number of empty triangles next to each other, and the honeycomb structure has more than the stripes over here. So that actually leads to selection of this honeycomb valence bond crystal state, but it doesn't completely lift the degeneracy, because once you put the honeycomb lattice of these hexagons over here, in the middle of this of these hexagons, there is a pinwheel. And you can see that this pinwheel has the freedom to be dimerized in two different ways. I can do it this way, or I can do it by this magenta bonds over here. And that basically means that one is still left with a factor of 24 that has to do with the symmetries of the lattice. That is, this first hexagon can be put in any one of the 12 places, and then there's a reflection symmetry on which honeycomb lattice you want to get. So there's a 24 times 2 to the power n over 36 states are still left. Okay, so, and but that is a very, very low energy sector. So here is how the series expansion looks like in terms of numbers. So this is the order. These are the energies for the honeycomb valence bond crystal. This is the for the stripe valence bond crystal. And I'll come to this. This is what happens when you put the crystal on a 36-site periodic boundary condition cluster that Claire and others have studied. So everything is degenerate up to this order over here. And then in the third order, well, these are still degenerate. In the fourth order, this degeneracy is lifted. What you see basically is that the numbers are becoming smaller and smaller. There's an excellent convergence over here. And we estimate that in the limit, you know, because the series is converging rapidly, this honeycomb VBC state has an energy which is given by minus 0.433. If we consider, but the energy difference over here between these two is less than one in the last place over here. Okay, and in fact, there are lots of configurations which are still to be resolved. Now, if we look at the 36-site periodic boundary condition, basically, it turns out that the cluster that they consider, let me first show this over here. So the cluster that they actually consider can have a unit cell. So this honeycomb structure has a unit cell of 36 sites, and it one unit cell can be fitted into the 36-site cluster that they considered. But a unit cell of the stripe cannot be fitted in there. Now, when you put periodic boundary condition, what that means, for example, is that this 10 and 22 over here, this 10 is the same as this 10 over here. This 31 is the same as this 31 over here, and this 1 is the same as this 1 over here. So what that does is basically these graphs begin to wrap around. So for example, you can go from E1 to E2 to E4 to E5, and E1 is a neighbor of E5. So you have four triangles forming a closed loop. This wrap around actually begins to give extra contribution starting from fourth order. And so the energy jumps at this level over here, and it starts to become lower. And basically what we estimated is that this energy at the end of the day will be about 0.005 lower than this energy over here. And indeed, the energy of the 36 site periodic boundary condition cluster is calculated to be this number over here. This is the number you get from exact diagonalization. Now, I should also compare with the energy of the variational state that Patrick Lee and collaborators studied. They studied all kinds of spin liquid states, of which they found one had the lowest energy. And the number they got was -0.429. So one thing to remember, that these are all energy per lattice site. If you are working with, say, a 64-site cluster, which is what they were doing, this energy difference of 0.004 will actually correspond to an energy difference of about 0.2. So it's not that small, really. Okay, and the spin gap in these systems at 36-site cluster is 0.15. Okay, so these are the energies that one gets. Now, we can also now talk about the dimer order parameter, and this is the question that Daniel was raising earlier about do the hexagons resonate or do they stay dimerized? So we have actually, this is a calculation still really in progress, but what I have calculated is, to various order in perturbation theory, what is the energy on the strong bond within the hexagon that I start off with, and what's the energy on the weak bond within the hexagon. Now, this has been calculated now to sixth order, and I estimate that this number is going to go to about -0.4. On the other hand, the weak bond, this is a slightly harder calculation because it's off diagonal perturbation in our calculation over here, but you can see that already in second order, this has gone higher than the energy per bond. And basically, you know, the energies are hardly changing order by order. So as this one goes down, this one has to go up. So it's quite likely that both these guys will end up with a number very close to -0.4, which means that the hexagons will be fully resonating. But this number is very different from this number. That tells you that the dimerization order parameter is still robust, okay? That the average energy per bond is larger in the hexagons than on average. Yes.
Here you do not have any small parameter to control the convergence of the position.
That's right. When you go to lambda equal to 1, yes.
Yes, and they do converge.
They do appear to converge pretty well. But not all quantities converge. I'm going to discuss the gap very quickly. Right. You can see that this is converging extremely well. In fact, I have a few more terms, so I think I can say that this number is going to be 4327, something like that. Okay.
Which would be very surprising for unfrustrated lattice.
That's right. So this will not converge if you were to do it for a square lattice, clearly. Yeah, and it doesn't even converge this well for the J1, J2 model. So we were quite surprised that it converges so well.
Excuse me. The number of hexagons for the stripe and honeycomb is different, right?
It's the same.
It's the same?
Yes. They are all as closely packed hexagons as you like, but there are infinitely many ways to do that.
In the picture that you showed, they were the same number?
Yes. The unit cell in both cases is 36. If you count the unit cell, involves...
20, there are 20 here.
Well, you have to ask what is the size of the unit cell. The unit cell has 36 sites, and in each unit cell there are two. Again, here also the unit cell, you know, of the honeycomb lattice has two of these guys, and it has 36 sites. So it has the same number of hexagons per lattice site. Okay, well, it also sort of reminded us of Kagome stripes. This was a system first proposed by Azaria and Swellick and Claire and various other people as a just, if you take just a stripe like this of the Kagome lattice, that is just three lines of the lattice, and ask what kind of ground state is obtained in the system over here. And in fact, they had very fancy arguments to suggest that it might have non-degenerate ground state, but then gapless singlet modes, basically. They were trying to understand large number of singlets in the Kagome system. Now, Steve White did very careful renormalization DMRG study of this and essentially found that this model dimerizes, and the pattern is essentially a stripe-like pattern. But remember, when you take something like this, you are breaking the threefold symmetry of the Kagome lattice. Okay, this is really focusing only on one direction, and basically you get these strong hexagons and then weak ones and then strong ones and so on. So exactly a very similar pattern is obtained over here with a very small energy gap. Okay, now what about the spin spectra? Now, calculation of the spectra is much harder than in a typical model here, because for lambda equal to 0, you have 18 different excitations, because I can take any one of these bonds and promote the singlet into a triplet. So there are 18 elementary excitations in the unit cell. And of course, when we do the perturbation theory, then essentially one would obtain, when you integrate out all the other higher energy sectors, one would obtain an 18 by 18 matrix for the excitations. Now, what happens, though, to low orders is quite interesting. Suppose we only consider up to second order perturbation theory, then it's partly like bits of a chain, and it's partly like the Shastri-Sutherland model. So if we think of this hexagon over here, at low orders, this is basically like a small ring over here, a small chain. So it's similar to what happens in a 1D chain over here. But partly you have the character of the Shastri-Sutherland lattice, that is, this bond is part of this triangle over here. This triplet cannot hop over here, okay? Because if it does, it must leave back a triplet over here. So it can only perform a virtual hop over there, not a real hop. However, there can be grounds. The fact that the triplet can perform virtual hop and hop back actually lowers the energy of the triplet, okay? So there are two kinds of effects. And basically what happens in this model is that if we just take these two effects, then in the very, the lowest energy turns out to be one that is where the triplet is hopping around inside the hexagon over here. It's a Q equal to zero excitation inside the hexagon. Up to third order, in fact, that remains an eigenstate. That is the lowest energy state. But then in higher order, it becomes weakly dispersive. But essentially, there is a sort of a network, if you like, on which it moves. These pinwheels and some of the bonds around them, they remain rigid. And the triplets have to hop around this sort of fragile network over here. Okay, and the convergence is not very good. I've done some, one has to use some Padé approximants and so on. And what happens is that I'm getting an energy of the order of 0.05, with a bandwidth which is also very small, of the order of 0.04. So there are lots of states very near the edge. Okay, so that's our calculation. Now let me come back to why there are some question marks still about whether this is the true ground state of the model. So let's get back to the exact diagonalization. One of the things that Ms. Gwich and Senzanger have done is basically they have enumerated the symmetry of various low-lying states of the system. And this valence bond crystal state, essentially, so one of the lattice symmetries is this R3. R3 is the threefold rotational symmetry of the Kagome lattice. Okay, so if you rotate by 120 degrees, that is a symmetry. This valence bond crystal state actually is an eigenstate of that. It's a unique state under that. It goes back to itself. But they get some low-lying states that are basically...
Not the stripe one.
Not the stripe, but the stripe doesn't fit on this lattice. You're right. The stripe, however, does not fit on this lattice. Okay. So what that shows is that, so naively one would expect that if you have a valence bond crystal state, that you should have these states which are symmetry related to each other should be separated from all other states. Now, certainly on the 36-site cluster, that is not true. And one can see that in various ways. One is that, you know, all the low-lying, the quantum number of the low-lying states do not match up. The other is there is a study by Mambrini and Mila where they studied the Hamiltonian in the subspace of dimers, and they find that basically you don't have any gaps. There is no set of states which are separated from all others. It's basically one smooth continuum. So to me, what this suggests is that dimer order has not yet set in at this length scale of the 36-site cluster. Okay, so the and one way of seeing that is that the energy of the periodic boundary condition is much larger than the typical energy separation between the states that we were studying. Okay, so 36 site is really not big enough for the setting up of this order. So what's the overall picture from these studies? Well, the valence bond crystal order is very weak. The difference in the energy between stripe state and this crystal state, honeycomb state, is only of order 0.001. So it only sets in at very low temperature, if it does, and for very large L. At intermediate length and temperature, the system is presumably a dimer liquid, where many dimer states are contributing. It's not clear to me whether it should be called an RVB or not. I mean, that's a matter of how much coherence there is in the system. There's a small spin gap. And what we find is that, you know, the lowest energy excitations are really nearly localized triplets. They are just moving around in the hexagon and weakly dispersing from hexagon to hexagon. But there are lots of singlets at the gap edge because the bandwidth is very small. And what this does is that the susceptibility actually continues to grow down to very low temperatures in the system. And of course, because the energy scales are so small, the system is going to be very sensitive to all kinds of perturbations.
I don't quite understand why singlets contribute to
susceptibility. Sorry, singlet do not, but I should have said lots of triplets here at the gap edge. Sorry, the triplet, they are hardly hopping. They are almost localized, and so there are lots of triplets right at the gap edge. Sorry, this should have been a triplet here. Okay, so that sort of concludes the theoretical part of the talk. Is there a question here?
Do we also calculate susceptibility?
No, we have not calculated. What susceptibility should we calculate?
A spin susceptibility.
Spin susceptibility. No, we haven't done that. No, we could, yeah.
What about single states? You just have shown this clear data. And it seems that single states are kind of the most important part of the story.
That's right,
where
yeah.
They are in your story, and what are they?
Well, so right. So in our, so what we would find, what this suggests is that there would be 48. I mean, if the dimer order had really set in, there should be 48. So in the exact diagonalization, you have about 200 states below the lowest triplet, but really the spectrum is not. It's not like, you know, there are 200 states and then there is nothing. The singlet spectrum just keeps going. The singlet density of states just keep growing. Okay, there are 200 below the lowest triplet. Now, what we would argue is that there are 48 states which are at the lowest energy. Another 48 of them, if you had started with the, you can take this hexagon and you can orient this hexagon the other way. So there are 96 states on this cluster with two perfect hexagons. And there are literally thousands of states with one perfect hexagon. The energy cost of one perfect hexagon is only 0.002 in this unit. So it's not so big. So lots of singlet states are possible.
In your picture, these singlet states would be simply different dimer calories.
Different dimer, some linear superposition of them, yes. But it's possible that this does not cover all the states. Actually, there are some states which are of other type within the... in the exact diagonalization. Okay, so we don't certainly have a clear 200 number. It's more like 100, plus maybe many more. There are thousands if you start considering states with one perfect hexagon.
And you also mentioned actually this idea of fractional excitations. Do you have them, and can you explain maybe if you were to say, what would they be if you proceed from this picture?
Well, if I proceed from this picture, you will not have fractional excitations because it's a valence bond crystal state, and so spin half excitations would be confined. You know, if you break a bond, basically, suppose I replace this by a hole over here, then the spin would be. Essentially, there would be a spin developing right there.
Is that because of
because of long-range order? Yes.
Good question. Do you know if the honeycomb state that you find, is that one of the competing orders that's present in this algebraic spin distance?
That I don't know. I mean, maybe we can talk about that. Okay, so this new material, it has been discussed before in this meeting. The Herbert Smithites, they have this chemical formula over here. It's zinc, copper, hydroxide, chloride. The copper atoms carry spin half, and they form Kagome layers like this. So if you just focused on this one layer, essentially, and if you just focused on the coppers, they're supposed to form a structurally perfect Kagome lattice. That is the claim. And these things are basically OH groups over here. So in some sense, this is like the cuprates. This is the O here, and that's the H. But the three-dimensional structure is much more complicated. Well, I do have a picture, but it's not a very good one. so you have these layers. This is a pyrochlore lattice, essentially. So you have layers, these Kagome layers, which are supposed to have these coppers, and then in between you have the triangular layers, which are supposed to have zinc. So zinc is non-magnetic here, and it is supposed to separate these Kagome layers. Now, the chemists argued that, you know, this should be a very pure system, but there is a growing evidence that it's not as pure as one would like. So basically, these Kagome sites are highly distorted. I mean, you know, you have four oxygens in the plane and two chlorines out of the plane. So the octahedra is highly distorted there. The other octahedra is not so distorted. And so the argument is that, you know, copper likes, because of the Jahn-Teller effect, to go into these distorted sites. And so one might expect, you know, that the energy difference, it's like a chemical potential that the copper has, which is of the order of electron volt, to go into the Kagome site. But of course, crystals are not drawn in equilibrium. And so it's not obvious that, you know, at the end of the day, when these crystals are produced, all the copper sites will be on the Kagome and all the zinc sites will be on the triangles. And in fact, there is some evidence that that is not the case. So and to some extent, that complicates the interpretation of the experiments, but I mean, maybe by improved, I mean, I think in equilibrium one would expect all the coppers to go in here, so it should be possible to get more pure system, like, you know, and reduce the impurities. But anyway, the claim is that if you look at the X-ray scattering, it's very, very nice, and, you know, it looks like there is very low disorder here. And the system has a Curie-Weiss constant of order 300 Kelvin, yet it shows no long-range order down to 50 millikelvin. Okay, so amazing, you know, more than 1,000 times, more than several thousand times below the exchange constant J. But what is unusual is that the susceptibility actually turns up. So this is a plot of the inverse susceptibility as a function of temperature. For antiferromagnets, one expects the susceptibility to turn up like this. Instead, the susceptibility turns like that. Is this due to Curie impurities? Or is this, what is the physics of this? I'll come to that. There's also specific heat data. The specific heat is actually, this is specific heat at various magnetic fields. But if you look at the specific heat data at small fields, I guess it's somewhere over here. It's also plotted over here. The specific heat shows sublinear behavior. Okay, it's as if it's a power of, if you want to fit it as T to some power, that power is actually less than 1. This is a linear plot and that's a sublinear plot. Okay, why is there? But also, this specific heat is very magnetic field dependent. So as you apply a magnetic field, a lot of this goes away, and this is a TQ behavior over here. Basically, the phonons have not been subtracted because there's no material whereby the phonons can be independently determined and subtracted over here. So there's a lot of specific heat, but it comes not from singlet degrees of freedom, but really from magnetic degrees of freedom. So a lot of it may be due to impurities. What Marcos and I did was, you can take the high temperature susceptibility and try to fit it using high temperature expansions and something we call numerical link cluster expansion. And basically what you find is that you can fit it extremely well. So this is really the experimental data from two different groups, which falls right on top of each other. And this is what happens for the Heisenberg model. So it fits well, but below some temperature, which is below some temperature of order 0.75J or something, it begins to deviate from the Heisenberg model result. And we get a J value which is around 170 Kelvin. Now, if there are impurities, the J value will go up a little bit, because if you have to remove something. Now, one interesting point, really, before I start discussing the experimental data fits, is just for the pure Heisenberg model, where does the susceptibility peak? At what temperature does the Kagome lattice Heisenberg model susceptibility have a peak? That itself is not clear from the theory so far. So this is some... Let me go to this plot over here and skip this one, because it's the same information. So this shows, if you carry out a high temperature expansion and simply add up the terms in the series, well, the high temperature expansions have a certain radius of convergence. So up to that temperature, they will give you convergence. Above that, below that temperature, they will not give you the correct answer unless you use some Padé approximants or something like that. When you use these various Padé approximants or this numerical link cluster method, you can go down to some temperature again, which is of the order of 0.2 or so. But the susceptibility keeps on increasing. Now, there's also exact diagonalization result, actually, for n equals 18 and n equals 24. And up to this temperature, the lowest temperature that we can calculate, it falls right on top of the exact diagonalization answers. This blue line over here is a result from n equals 36. It's not exact, but it's a kind of density of states calculation that should be numerically accurate. And it suggests that actually the susceptibility keeps on increasing all the way down to 0.1 in temperature. That's... In my view, this is a crossover to a reduced number of localized triplets. So basically what is happening is that the triplets are basically gradually freezing out, but there are these very low energy triplets which are also localized. So they have very large density of states right at the edge. And those are what are causing, you know, the susceptibility to continue to go up. This is for the model. Now, what about the experiment? So the first question is the upturn due to impurities? And again, we did some fits which were similar to what Ms. Gwich and Senzanger did. And so let me just go to their fit, because it looks nicer here. So this is the experimental data. And they have the temperature scale there, and this is the theory scale here. If you subtract off some impurities, then you can make the data fit well down to a temperature of order 0.2 or even lower, okay, all the way down to maybe a temperature of 25 or so. Except that in order to get this good a fit, one needs to also add a ferromagnetic Curie constant for the impurities. It's not simple impurities, really. Okay, and of course, if you do that, then below some temperature, the chi experimental minus chi impurity will become negative over here. Okay, so it clearly cannot be valid below a temperature of 10 Kelvin or so. Okay, so impurities, so without impurities, you can fit it maybe down to this temperature. With impurities, you can fit it down to this temperature, but you cannot really fit the data well in a simple way.
So by impurities, you mean simply missing copper?
Simply, right? As if they are just a sum, as if the susceptibility is the susceptibility of the Kagome plus an impurity contribution, wherever it is coming from. Okay, well, now there are other experiments like muon spin rotation experiments. So muon shift tracks the bulk susceptibility. And that, of course, suggested to us that, you know, that there is very little disorder in this material. But there are also some claims based on neutron scattering, for example, that there is substantial anti-site disorder, which is what I was talking about earlier, that some of the zinc may go into the copper site, some of the copper may go into the zinc site, which means that you will be diluting the layers and also creating extra spin, which are very weakly coupled between the layers. Okay, and as much, although this, I suspect, must be sample dependent, but at least in the sample that they studied, as many as 6% of the copper site might be replaced by zinc. Okay, here is NMR data. There are various groups that have done NMR. This is from Takashi Imai's group. Again, it shows that the impurities are not simple. So basically what one finds, let me just focus on this main peak over here. He understands these two horns in terms of nuclear quadrupolar effects, that basically this peak is pretty sharp at high temperature. At 77 Kelvin, it's still pretty sharp. But then as you go below 50 Kelvin, it begins to broaden, and it becomes extremely broad. Okay, so it's not like you have an impurity peak and you have a peak that corresponds to the system and they are behaving differently. It's really one peak which is fairly narrow at high temperatures and becomes extremely broad at low temperature. And if you follow the intensity, the shift at half maximum, basically, that shift at half maximum looks just like the bulk susceptibility. It in fact fits right on the squid measurements. But if you were to follow the edge over here, that shows a different behavior.
What do you mean by shift at half maximum? You mean the low frequency?
So this is the measure of the shift over here. So the the hyperfine constant is negative, so a larger shift in this direction actually means a larger susceptibility. So if you just followed the value, so take the half maximum over here.
But on the low frequency side?
On the low frequency side, that is where the larger susceptibility is. If you just followed the shift there, that would that basically follows the squid measurement. Okay, so this, of course, the fact that it is so temperature dependent suggests that the inhomogeneity may also be temperature dependent. It's not simple impurities, but probably some impurities are present. The other thing that one has to worry about are Zyloshinsky-Moria interactions, because the Kagome lattice structure, even though it's a structurally perfect system, basically the, I'm sorry, I don't have a good figure here, the coppers, they are in a strongly distorted environment, basically, and that in the Kagome system, there are two independent Zyloshinsky-Moria parameters that are allowed. One is the Zyloshinsky-Moria vector could be perpendicular to the planes, and once you have fixed that on one bond, the symmetry of the lattice fixes it on all the other bonds. And this, of course, this is, if we call this DZ over here, this DZ within the state of 120 degrees, within this 120 degree subspace, this DZ uniquely fixes the ground state, actually. Remember, the whole point about the Kagome system was that the site, it's a site sharing or corner sharing lattice, and so the order was not propagating. But if you have DZ, then the order immediately begins to propagate because you fix the chirality. What DZ does, it wants, first of all, the spins to lie in the plane, but it also wants them to have a definite chirality. So once this spin is fixed in this direction, it fixes this spin in this direction and this one in this direction. So the entire lattice gets fixed by this, and you start to develop classically this 120 degree in this subspace. You immediately begin to order the system.
You hear a chirality.
Q equals 0, right. It will order at Q equal to 0. Right. On the other hand, there is another kind of Zyloshinsky-Moria interaction, which is where the Zyloshinsky-Moria vectors point perpendicular to the bonds over here, and that varies from one bond to another. And that also, once you fix it on one bond, is fixed on the entire lattice by the symmetry. But now, this is a highly frustrating one because you cannot obviously have the spins perpendicular to all three of them. Okay, so there is no way to satisfy these. And typically what it does in classical systems is it causes a canting of the spins. So it likes the spins to cant out of the plane, and basically it creates a ferromagnetic Ising anisotropy. Okay, so it, you can see that this can create large susceptibilities as well. So one of the things that we did was basically sort of numerically study what happens when we put Zaleshinsky-Moria interaction. Now, because there are no symmetries over here, by the time you put dz and dx, you have to diagonalize the full Hilbert space, really. The lack of conservation laws makes the numerics harder. So we've only been able to do the 12 and 15 side cluster over here and get our results from there. But basically, this is what the results look like. So this is the experimental data over here. This is the Heisenberg model data. In general, this is a busy slide, but I have a very simple message over here. When we put dz, the susceptibilities go down. When you put dp, the susceptibilities go up. Now, in order to fully match the susceptibility data with a pure Heisenberg model with an isotropy, you need rather large an isotropy. I'm not necessarily suggesting that this is the experimental case. I mean, impurities can bring this down considerably, okay, the dp that is needed to match with the experiments. But if you try to fit it, you will need pretty large values of this anisotropy parameter. It's interesting also to look at what happens to the entropy function. So when we put dz...
So these are single, they are available in single crystal, right?
No, they're not single crystal, they're powder. So, right, so that's certainly the anisotropy is one way to distinguish impurities from Zaleshinsky-Moria interactions. But so far, people have not yet done the...
So with this dp, the spins would be canted. So if you put a reasonable dp, and let's say, yeah, what would be the canted de-Ising moment in Bohr magneton?
It need not develop long-range order.
No, but it would
only
be
susceptible. It's only becoming more susceptible, really. It's like a ferromagnetic Ising anisotropy. So if we look at the entropy, let me just focus here on the entropy over here. So basically, if we put the dz term, as I discussed earlier, the system classically likes to order in this planar arrangement, basically, with fixed chirality. Even quantum mechanically, what we see is that the entropy rapidly decreases. Okay, the entropy of the system, this temperature is only going down to about 0.15. As you increase the dz, and this is a sign that the system is going to develop order, whereas what is interesting is that if you put dp, the entropy is essentially, to our real surprise, is that the entropy is hardly changed. The dp term, even a very large dp term, hardly affects the entropy of the system.
But classically, with the dp, don't you keep the degeneracy at the classical levels?
Classically, you start to cant, and you can still develop.
But the components which is not canted can still be swapped among.
It can be, but I think there are simulations classically that show that it will develop long-range order at a lower temperature, classically, by one of your collaborator canals and other.
But just classically for the ground state, if you have a dp and you can them, don't you still keep a positive degeneracy? Because they're canted, but I can still rotate them perpendicular in the xy plane, say. And so, you see what I mean? One is canted at 100 degrees, the other one at 0 degree and 240 degrees, and I can swap them. And so you still have a...
It's still a very frustrated system, yes.
But we take positive degeneracy. And so if the... No?
I think you do, but I believe their claim based on simulations is that you still develop long-range order, classically. Okay, well, this is, a slide from Miskwich and Sanzanger. Looking at the entropy as a function of temperature. Now, it's been very difficult to calculate the entropy at low temperatures using something like high temperature expansion. But there was a technique developed by Bernou and Miskwich, a very clever technique, which allows you to get to input low temperature and ground state information into a high temperature expansion thus allowing you to get things all the way down to zero temperature. So what they basically do is, in a high temperature expansion, one can calculate the entropy as a function of 1 over T. One can calculate the energy as a function of 1 over T. So analytically, one can make transformation of variables and get entropy as a function of energy. If you know what the ground state energy is from, say, some zero temperature calculation, then you can demand that at that energy, the entropy goes to zero. And you can also demand, if you know that you have, say, T square type if you know the energy of the excitation, you can build that also into the extrapolation of the series. And this is a really effective method. It allows you for linear chain and square and triangular lattice to get the low temperature dependent, the low temperature specific heat. It doesn't work too well for the Kagome lattice model because we don't really know what the ground state properties are here. Okay, so for example, they were using exact diagonalization numbers. The energy is not known accurately. One doesn't know if the gap is zero or not. So depending on what they try, they get a variety of answers at low energies. But of course, it's a high temperature expansion. So above some temperature, and that's a pretty low temperature over here, like 0.07, above this temperature, they have a very accurate estimate. So these represent theoretical calculations over here. So they are very inaccurate at low temperatures, but they become accurate above some temperature. And this is showing the experimental data over here. Now, there is a certain danger in extrapolating, in integrating the entropy from, in integrating specific heat from zero, because you don't really know if the entropy at low temperature should be set to zero. There may be a frozen-in entropy, okay, a glass-type entropy over here. So one might want to shift this. But if you assume that there is no frozen-in entropy over here, then basically their conclusion is that the experiments have a much reduced entropy compared to the Heisenberg model. If that is the case, then that would imply that one should have a dz term as well, okay, which would reduce the entropy over here. So, but as I said, the other possibility is that the experimental entropy, there is some frozen-in entropy at low temperatures, so you should shift this whole curve up. Okay, so my conclusions for these finite temperature studies is that if we put in different Zariszynski-Moria interactions, dz reduces the entropy, it reduces isotropic susceptibility, it leads to long-range XY order, and this, of course, can't be the answer by itself. There's no evidence of any spin freezing or ordering in this system. dp, on the other hand, produces no change in entropy at high temperatures. It increases the susceptibility in a sharp way, very similar to the experiments, and it makes it highly anisotropic, of course. The susceptibility is much larger along the z-axis than in the xy plane. And, this could be the answer, at least for part of it. And these conclusions have to be modified if there are significant impurity effects. Actually, with impurities, one might need much smaller dz and maybe even a much smaller dp. Actually, and if there are measurements of the anisotropy, that would be very useful because then one can separate out the impurity effects from Zariszynski-Moria. I see.
Experimentally,
that may be hard to. I see. Okay, so. Just the final conclusions for this talk. So Kagome lattice, I say, may have a valence bond crystal ground state. A lot of people took exception at the title of our paper that said ground state of the Kagome lattice Heisenberg model. So the debate is not over, but we presented evidence that there is a state, valence bond crystal state, which has a very good energy, okay? It has many interesting properties. Perfect hexagons may be more robust than the fragile valence bond crystal. And clearly, very low temperatures or very short length scales are destroying the valence bond crystal order. But maybe perfect hexagons are more robust. And, there's very small energy scales between different phases. And it's not clear. This may lead to some glassy behavior. There's a very small triplet gap, and there are lots of states right near the edge, which is why the susceptibility does not peak down to quite low temperatures. Okay, the Zariszynski-Moria interactions are allowed in these systems, and they will be there It's only the magnitudes that can vary. Discussed that DZ and DP are quite different. DP is very intriguing, and it's not clear what it does to the ground state, basically. I guess one of the big questions really is, if there is an exotic state, suppose there is a Dirac spin liquid phase, in presence of these Zyrushinsky-Moria interactions and in presence of these anisotropies, how can one convincingly establish that state? I mean, that's a very important question here. So, thank you.
I was wondering about this expansion you made. Is there any reason that it converges so well?
If you have a valence bond crystal state, then it should converge well. Otherwise, there is no reason. So, in fact, you know, without looking at anything else, we were very excited to see that it was converging so well. You know, when Patrick Lee gave this talk and David suggested that we should look at these Kagome systems, our first guess was, you know, maybe we should look at some magnetically ordered state. But then you look at the exact diagonalization results, and they are strongly suggesting that it's not magnetic order, but something to do with singlets. So maybe the first thing we should do is really try a dimer expansion. But we didn't know if it was going to converge or what kind of results would come out. But if it was converging so well, it certainly suggests that this is a well-defined state, really. There could be a first-order transition. There's a possibility that some other state is equally good and you know, crosses this state around lambda equal to 1, and there's a first-order transition to something else. That certainly cannot be ruled out from this calculation.
Since you were talking about the actual material, and I was wondering, you have a couple of issues in the state of D9, right?
Yes.
So apparently there is a hole in one of the D orbitals, and I was wondering if you can comment on which orbital actually takes a hole. Do you worry about...
Well, I have certainly not worried about it. I mean, I would guess that it should be dx square minus y square, but I'm just guessing here completely. It's very anisotropic.
Oxygen and 2 chloride,
that's the problem. Because that will change some of the problems. And then I have another question. If you have looked at, if you actually thought about hydrogen and 0.1 motion of hydrogen, how that can influence our degeneracy.
There is, Takashi Imai's NMR data has some interesting things to say about that, but you know, it's not published yet, so it's still confidential what he's doing. So there is some evidence that something happens to the proton motion, and maybe the temperature-dependent, and I saw the temperature-dependent impurities may be partly due to that, you know, coming from the freezing of the protons.
I missed actually the point, and so my fault for me. The perfect hexagon, can you just remind once again what you call a valence bond crystal and what you call perfect hexagon?
Okay. Perfect hexagon is a local valence bond order. So in other words, let me just...
Local hexagon, but no long range order, or what?
That's right. So just one individual hexagon...
For real Kagome.
For the real Kagome.
What would it be?
It would be a resonating state over here where, right, you know, this state is much strongly correlated, if you like, than all the neighboring states. That's what I mean by perfect hexagon. So it's a short range order of this type.
Yeah, but in a sense, actually, for a long range order picture with this blue hexagon, they also contain this perfect hexagon.
Yes.
Plus something else. So
plus, right.
In this sense, I don't quite understand your conclusion that perfect hexagon are better than...
No.
Also contain the same perfect hexagon plus something else.
What it means is this is a question of long-range order versus short-range order. That short-range order may be more robust than the long-range order. That's what I meant. Yeah.
Any other question?
Short-range order of hexagons or... on the vertical. So if you go to this fourth order, that's the ground that's completely selective.
No.
No.
But
there are still
not only that, there are of course 24-fold degeneracy from the lattice structure, but there is a 2 to the power n over 36. So there's still infinitely many states. But they are very, very small number. If you think in terms of entropy, you're talking about 1 over 36, which is a pretty small entropy really. So they're very small and they are extremely weakly coupled in this picture.
Okay.
So when you were talking about the residual entropy with this Miss Squish value fitting, you were talking about the experiment, right?
I was talking about the experiment there, yeah.
Okay, so let's take a picture again. So next week, Monday, there will be